The Economic Development Budget Division for Wednesday, February 7th will come to order. Today we've got governor's budget presentations from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and from the Department of Labor and Industry. So we'll start out with Commissioner Tim Marks. And welcome to the committee again.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much and good to be here again. You should have in your packets two items. The first is a PowerPoint presentation that I'll be walking through. And the second is a two-page summary of the budget that's also in the presentation, but I'll be referring to it separately. It has on the front page kind of some yellow columns that is a summary of the budget that I'll be referring to. And, Mr. Chair, members, I have about a 35, 40-minute presentation. Feel free to speed me up or slow me down and ask questions as we go through this presentation. What I will do is...
Yeah, members, don't hesitate to ask questions if you've got a question. He's making his presentation. And
Chair, we're so shy.
I think a quorum is present. I noticed that.
Mr. Chair, is it just amendments that are out of order?
Yeah,
if you have amendments to this,
here.
you can put one on right now.
We're just looking for clarification, Mr. Chair.
We're going to hear all the bills, you guys, I think. Okay, Commissioner, go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, what I will do is walk through the PowerPoint presentation and refer you to the pages as I go along. And I'm on page 2, which is a summary of what I'd like to visit with you about today. I would like to refresh you about our total affordable housing plan or program budget, talk about the geographic distribution of our assistance.
Before you go any further, yep. Have you been able to cross-reference your PowerPoint with the budget pages?
Yes, this document right here will cross-reference with the budget pages. And so as I go through the detail, okay. I will point you to the pages in the budget book that you can refer to should
all
you
right,
so choose.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Okay, go ahead.
And so I'll talk about the income distribution of the housing assistance, geographic distribution, then I'll go through in detail the governor's proposed budget. And for your reference, in the materials are the proposed budget bill language and the department results from the website that reports that information. I don't intend on going through that in any detail. To page 3 in the PowerPoint presentation, this is a reminder of Minnesota Housing's total program budget, which all sources combined, state and federal, and our own internal resources, is $1.3 billion. And to remind you that all state appropriations go for programs, we self-fund our operations. And if you look at the left-hand side of, or the left pie chart, you see that 8% figure, that is the state appropriations that we receive from this body to run housing programs. And although it is a relatively small portion of our budget, it is very important resources because it is those resources that allow us to do quality projects and to serve very low-income households. Those soft deferred loans and that deep down payment assistance is very important to have the type of results that we have. Going to the next page 4, just to refresh you on the incomes that we serve, this pie chart demonstrates that 75% of the households we serve have incomes of $20,000 or less, and $20,000 is the approximate poverty level for a household of 4 for reference purposes. Page 5 is in response to a question we received in the overview about where our resources go throughout the state. And on page 5, you see 2 maps, and I'll first talk about the map on the left. And the intent of these maps is to show the proportionality across the state between eligible population and amount of resources that you receive from Minnesota Housing. If you look at the box chart to the right of the first map, you'll see that the greater Minnesota has 45% of the eligible households for Minnesota Housing Assistance and received for the year ending September 30, 2006, 49% of the resources. And the converse is true for the metro area, 54% eligible and 51% of the resources. What the map depicts by region, again, is relative proportionality. So each region has a ratio presented to it. If a ratio is 1, that means there's proportionality between eligible households and resources received. If the ratio is greater than 1, that means there is a greater proportion of resources received than eligible households. And so, for example, you see northeastern Minnesota has a ratio of 1.15, which means that it receives a greater proportionate share of resources than eligible households. The next map over on the right depicts that in terms of percent of households served. So it's really the same data, but looking at it in terms of households served instead of percent of funds disbursed. And you see the same relative numbers between the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota. What I think that this chart demonstrates overall, or these maps demonstrate overall, is that between the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota, there is a rough proportionality between eligible households and resources received, both in terms of numbers and dollars. There are various regional disparities, however. I think the point to remember, however, is that we are market-driven. We are responsive to proposals received from developers, from local governments, and from community groups. We try to do as good a job as we can, and I think do a very good job, of getting the information out about our resources, provide technical assistance to those who might want to apply, and encourage applications, but we can't control who really applies. And we think that if there is a shortfall of those who are applying for our resources, there may be, for any number of reasons, not the type of need that is that they are applying for, or there's some other circumstances. And we look at that and try to provide additional outreach where we think there is the potential for a region being underserved.
Commissioner, are these maps an average of what all your programs do?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
so
yes.
So it's not just one particular program.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is kind of agency-wide look at all of our programs. Then we do a program-by-program analysis as well.
Okay.
Moving on to page 6, I won't spend any time on this table, but this is a table depicting basically the same information by region that has the same information that was summarized by the map. The next page, again, is a summary of our proposed budget by program, and I want to just point out two things. Over on the far right is the $114 million total that the governor is requesting for the agency, and you see footnote 4 there. This is in response, I think it was a question that Senator Olson had during the overview about how that $114 million relates to inflation. And if you looked at the pre-fiscal crisis biennium of 2002-2003, our state appropriations were $108 million for that biennium. If you adjusted it by CPI, that $114 million would be $124 million instead. If you adjusted it by the RS Means Construction Inflation Index, which generally is a bit higher than CPI, that $114 million would be approximately $144 million. Regardless of that comparison, we do think this is a robust housing budget that the governor has proposed. And if there is an area of shortfall, it really is the federal government, which particularly in Section 8 and in public housing has been doing significant disinvestment. And we do need to work together to try to reverse that disinvestment. But again, I think the budget the governor has presented is very robust. What I'd like to do now is kind of go through the details of this table. It's on page 8 of the PowerPoint, and you also have the separate document here that I can walk through and is a key to the budget detail and the rest of the PowerPoint presentation. So the way this document is constructed, you'll see on the far left column, you see the program category, and our program categories are in 5 categories labeled down the left. And the page numbers in that far left column refer to the page descriptions in the remainder of this PowerPoint description, a PowerPoint presentation that I will be reviewing. The next column over is the particular program description, and the page numbers there are to the overall description in the budget pages that you have in your budget book for that program. The next column over is the appropriations for this biennium. The next column is the household served during this current biennium, as we estimate it. The next column over is median household income for that program. The next program over, or next column over, is really the case or the information that we think justifies what the governor is proposing in terms of increases. The next column talks about what the total budget recommendation is. The diamond refers to the increase that the governor is recommending, and then the page number reference under that goes back again to your budget books and describes the change item. And then the final column is our estimate of the additional households that will be served with the additional resources that are being proposed. So that's how the document is constructed, and as you look at it and want me to refer to particular budget pages, I'm more than able to do that.
Commissioner, if you get to a spot where you have state money leveraging federal money, can you just let us know that this is one of those kind of situations? And I think you mentioned something about the federal government reducing Section 8 housing and something else. And maybe point out as you're going through the document how it affects your budget in those particular instances.
Mr. Chair, members, as a general proposition, the lack of growth and, in some cases, absolute cuts in federal resources affects the entire continuum of the programs that we have here. And as I go through, I will try to kind of point that out. The first program that I will talk to, and it's pages 9 to 12 of the PowerPoint presentation, is the Challenge Program. And this program, again, is our bread and butter workforce housing program through which we offer zero interest deferred loans for developers and local governments to construct new housing units, both ownership and multifamily. And we deliver that program through for-profit and nonprofit developers. We think the reason that this program merits an increase is because of the growth throughout the state that demonstrates that we are going to be having significant growth in low-income populations. They need housing for them and for the state to have a quality of life, and we need some subsidy dollars to assist them in that. The governor has proposed an increase of $15 million, and we think that will allow us to serve anywhere, depending upon the leverage factor. This is an area where the federal government comes in either with Section 8 assistance or appropriations to us through one of our federal programs, such as the Home Investment Partnership programs. Depending upon how much federal resources come in, local resources, employer resources, we'll be able to serve anywhere from an additional 500 to 1,000 households. Page 10 in the PowerPoint presentation is an example of a program or a housing development in Grand Rapids that was funded with this program in 2004. It's a 24-unit development in Grand Rapids that the total development cost was $2.8 million. The challenge investment was $755,000. This program also received federal tax credits, and the more federal tax credits that we receive and that are allocated, the less there is a need for a challenge and other investment. So that's another example of leveraging. And the type of individuals and households served here, again, are low-income individuals, in this instance that is profiled here, a single mother who had been having drug and financial problems, was able as well to draw down federal assistance through a Section 8 program, and if that resource was not available, she would not get the rental assistance she needs to be in this program, and she is now able to be adequately housed and turning her life around as a result of this program.
Is this a typical profile?
There are examples where we are serving those that are at the relatively low-income stream, and I think Tanya in Grand Rapids is an example. And if you kind of turn the page to the next example, page 11 is the Heart of the City development in Burnsville, a 34 townhouse development where we invested $500,000 of challenge funds for a total development cost of $7.4 million. These were probably, the units are these and rents here are probably more for higher income but low to moderate income individuals who have jobs and have access to services in that Burnsville area, working at the shopping mall, working at some of the service centers. And this is the type of the project that we want to do more of again, in order to reduce the burden on our transportation infrastructure, to do more infill development, to enhance environmental impact. So this is a...
So the spectrum is really broad of who gets the money.
It's very broad, yes, very broad. And it's our most flexible program, so we are able, again, to be responsive to market needs, both in the Twin Cities area and in greater Minnesota. The next slide, on page 12, reflects not resources used with the challenge program, but it's potential resources that an organization like Habitat for Humanity might use. As you, this development relates to a Habitat home built in Hibbing over the summer with lumber from the crash site where Senator Wellstone died, where a memorial was constructed.
I was there.
And we have a strong partnership with Habitat for Humanity. It has an excellent record of serving low incomes and emerging markets. One of the key challenges Habitat has right now is getting access to land affordably throughout the state. They were lucky here that St. Louis County donated some tax forfeit property. But if Habitat is going to continue its mission, it's important that they be able to acquire the land. And we foresee and are working with Habitat toward programs that would give them some of these challenge resources to be able to acquire land throughout the state to build these homes for these low-income working families. So that is the challenge program in terms of the description I will give to that. The next program category is homeless prevention and supportive housing, pages 13 to 18 of the PowerPoint presentation. And these are the set of programs that support the state's business plan to end long-term homelessness, related efforts at supportive housing and rental assistance for very low-income individuals so they don't become homeless, and our very good family homeless prevention program are all highlighted here. And you see that the governor is recommending, and I'll go over to the proposed 08-09 budget, significant new investments in these programs, $9.5 million for Housing Trust Fund, $2 million for the Bridges Program, and $7 million, a doubling of the program, for the Family Homeless Prevention Program, serving significant new numbers of households. And the reference pages are there in this summary chart. What I do, I have a couple of charts now that describe in more detail these programs. Again, these programs, I'll move right to slide 14 to give you some examples of individuals who are served under these programs. The first one is Steve, a disabled veteran from St. Paul, who had been on the streets in St. Paul for 19 years. Through the efforts of these programs, he is now housed and getting access to VA benefits and beginning to turn his life around. Sarah is another example of one who we have helped fund a particular outreach program with the St. Paul Police Department, where they work with the Dorothy Day Center and find people who have been on the streets, get them into housing. And Sarah is an example of a woman who had been on the streets for 30 years off and on, is now housed under these programs. Moving to slide 15 is an example of the type of capital development that would be facilitated and funded through this program. This depicts the Al Lair Veterans and Community Studio Apartments, a 60-unit single-room occupancy development in St. Cloud, owned by the St. Cloud HRA. Catholic Charities is the service provider. The Minnesota Assistance Council of Veterans is also involved, as is the VA Medical Center, in a strong partnership in a housing development that is serving homeless veterans and getting them off the streets. And the cost of that project was $6 million, and a similar project opened this fall in Minneapolis. Slide 16 is a summary of the progress we have made under the state's business plan to end long-term homelessness. The basic message is that we are ahead of goal and under budget. We wanted to be at 1,000 units by the end of last year in terms of housing opportunities. We reached 1,091. Our original planning estimates, we thought we were going to commit about $62 million. Instead, we were able to achieve that per unit cost with $44 million. And the primary reason is the market has been very responsive to pure rental assistance, that we didn't have to incur construction costs as opposed to capital costs, and we're able to serve people quickly and more efficiently by using more rental assistance.
Commissioner, is this I think the numbers, the average you should be spending on your on housing is like 30% of your income. Is that the reason that rental is being utilized more? Are people not able to afford the 30%? Or I mean, is the cost of housing too high for low-income people to actually have their own homes? Or what's the reason for the rental thing?
Mr. Chair, members, most of the programs that are structured, including this one, will require a tenant to pay 30 or 40% of their income for rent. But a lot of them, particularly the homeless, have no income, so 30% of zero is zero. So that, for that reason, you have to provide a significant amount of rental assistance. And that is why we also need to provide in other programs kind of gap financing assistance to bring the rents down to reduce the amount of amortizing debt that the rents have to support. But it's a function of income. Everybody is expected to pay something for rent. So if somebody is getting emergency assistance or if somebody is getting welfare payments, 30% of that still has to go to rent.
And have the increased property taxes over the last 3 or 4 years, how negative has the impact been as a result of that?
There has been a significant increase for affordable housing developments in their property tax in part because in many of the areas where developments have occurred, there's an affordable development next to a very expensive market rate development, and they've been assessed the same way. Two sessions ago, I believe the legislature made a change in the tax bill to help address that again, to provide a lower class rate for affordable developments that are rent restricted, and that is something I know the tax committee is going to be looking at again this year to provide rental property tax relief. Going on to slide 17, that depicts just on a geographic basis, and these are Senate districts are the geographic boundaries shown. The red dots or red people show where there are capital units being constructed, and this is really to demonstrate that the entire state is participating in the business plan to end long-term homelessness. Where you see the crosshatch on the Senate districts, that is where rental assistance is being provided to long-term homeless households. Again, these resources that are proposed by the governor are critical for us to stay on track with this plan. The next slide, slide 18, is a description of our Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. The example on the left is demonstrated to show how cost-effective it is to prevent homelessness rather than having to deal with the expense of homelessness. Hennepin County finds that it costs 10 times as much to serve a homeless person after they become homeless rather than preventing it. Dakota County puts it at a ratio of 14 to 1. And so we have, through this program, have a very flexible program to get monies into counties and social service providers to provide legal assistance to deal with the landlord, to provide emergency rental assistance, anything an individual needs to stay out of homelessness or get out of it quickly. And those that that go through this program have a very high success rate of staying out of homelessness. So that's why we are really being aggressive in this program and trying to double it. And this was very much key to the partner efforts that Hennepin County and Minneapolis and Ramsey County and St. Paul and Duluth and St. Louis and throughout the state. They really wanted to see an increase in these prevention resources as a part of their broader efforts to address homelessness. You see an example on the right-hand column of an example in Pennington County where a mother had a health problem, a father also had an employment issue, and as a result, they fell behind on their rent. Their landlord began eviction proceedings, heard about this program, provided the household and the family 2 months of rental assistance, and they're now back on track. That's the type of quick intervention that this program provides throughout the state that helps us keep homelessness from happening. So that, Mr. Chair, members, is a summary of the homeless prevention and supportive housing programs. The next set of programs is the home ownership programs, the third item down. And the primary item here is a recommendation by the governor of $1.77 million of a recapitalization of the homeownership assistance fund that is used to provide down payment assistance for low-income homeowners. And I'll go to slide 20 in the PowerPoint presentation. where this program was used for a family in Minneapolis, the Dixons. And I'll just point to the monthly payment difference that occurred. They have a monthly payment of $880. Without the assistance and at a market rate, their monthly payment would have been over $1,400, and this home would not have been affordable to this family. So that's an example of the type of resources we're able to utilize in this program and get people into home ownership. The next program description are our preservation programs. And the first is the PARIF program. And the base budget for the PARIF program is $17.9 million. And referring to slide 21, that is a program that we utilize to provide incentives to developers to stay in the federal program that provides them resources to keep rents low. And we provide incentives, a recapitalization, some rehabilitation money, and the developer or landowner or landlord must agree to stay in the federal program and keep the rents restricted. This is very cost-effective for us. For every another leverage point, Mr. Chair, for every $1 that we invest in this, we pull down over $5 of federal assistance. And this is an area where the federal government has not been kept up pace with its appropriations, and it's really important that they do so that, again, we can pull down those resources and leverage them with our resources and minimize the amount of resources that we have to put into it.
So have we gotten a better match in the past, 1-5? Have we gotten – was there more federal money in the past?
That is an average over time, and it's hard – overall, you can say that as a result of reduced federal money coming in, we're not getting as good as a leverage ratio. But that total leverage ratio really is deal-by-deal dependent as we negotiate with individual developers and try to figure out what do they really need in order to not go market rate. So it's a combination of the market negotiation with the developer and the federal appropriations. Going to page 22... you see throughout the state, again, this depicts Senate districts, where we have used this program for the approximately 53,000 units of federally assisted rental property through that program. Again, it's a broad statewide program where we're able to provide affordability throughout the state. The next program that is funded under this proposal is the Rehabilitation Loan Program, that the governor is recommending an additional $4.6 million for. And page 23 is an example of that program for Julia in Minneapolis, who thought she needed a roof. It turns out she needed a furnace, too. And by drawing down our resources as well as other resources, Julia is a senior citizen that was able to stay in her home, not go to a nursing home or some other housing alternative, and maintain good, safe, decent, affordable housing for her. It's a very good program for low-income individuals. Slide 24 is another example in Le Sueur County, where two elderly sisters, Linda and Tony, lived in that home without indoor plumbing since they were 4 years old. As they have been getting on in years, that became less of a viable housing alternative for them. And through our resources and other local resources, that home now has indoor plumbing and is accessible as they age as well. And again, they're able to age in place and not have to go to a nursing home as a result of this program. And we've also helped to preserve that housing stock.
That's sort of funny that that happened in Le Sueur County.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Well, that's why we need to be flush with resources, Mr. Chair.
Deranged.
The next initiative of the governor on page 25 is an initiative that the governor has to provide $2.5 million for our public housing stock. And this map on page 25 depicts where our 22,000 units of public housing exist. Again, they are statewide. This is a particular area in the last two or three federal budgets that the federal government has disinvested, made real cuts to our public housing agencies throughout the state. And we think we need to have enough state resources to prevent those units who are serving very low-income individuals, disabled individuals, and senior households, to prevent that stock from deteriorating and those units being lost. And again, the strategy issue is how much do we put in it and enable the federal government not to invest. And we think this is a reasonable amount to start taking care of some of the emergencies. And the next federal budget is starting to at least stop the bleeding, but we have a long way to go to make sure our housing federal housing stock is solid. The next program is our residential and organizational support program. This is primarily the HECAT program, Homeownership Education Counseling, and the governor is recommending an additional $820,000 in that program. This program generally funds items like the Wilder Research Survey of Homelessness, regional planning and coordination to provide technical assistance so that organizations have the ability to know about our programs and apply for them, and that we can provide good information through our website and other websites so that people know where vacancies are, is to keep the housing market healthy. We want to, as we look at the additional resources that are being recommended, focus them on areas that are increasing significant foreclosure increases. And page 27 gives you two examples of where our foreclosure prevention program, again, we fund many agencies through this program, have had real success. And there are two different examples. The first one on the left, Beverly and David, were living in their home for 20 years, only owned $37,000 on it, but there was a health problem and as a result, an employment problem, and they actually got into the foreclosure process. They were able to get connected with Habitat for Humanity. The health recovered. They were able to demonstrate they had income, and so they were able to negotiate and get financial assistance to get back on track with their mortgage payments and stay in the home. On the right-hand side, Annie, a homeowner in Stearns County, was unemployed and laid off and not making much income as she tried to put her law practice together, and she fell behind in her payments. And as a result of a negotiation with her mortgage company, was able to get a loan modification. But when we looked, or when Annie's situation was looked at, she is not going to have the sustainable income over the long term to stay in that home. So now she's getting help selling that home and getting into different housing that she can afford over the long term. And by not having to go through the foreclosure process, her credit is not marred, it's preserved, so that when and if she has the income again, she can get back into a home that she can afford with good credit. And that's the type of situation that we try to address with the foreclosure prevention program.
Commissioner, in the first instance, is that an instance where wages are being guaranteed for health care costs and so they can't afford the mortgage payments, or what happens in those kind of instances?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure about that specific instance, but that is something that could occur in order to prevent a person from being able to make their house payments, and that then they would want to access our resources. But I don't know how prevalent that is or whether that happened in this case. But we could do some digging and get back to you on that.
Well, I just thought that health care would be the last thing I'd pay, so that's why I was wondering what happened there.
I don't know.
Hello.
The next two things in the packet, Mr. Chair members, are the budget language, and we are proposing some minor modifications to the statute, as well as our department results. But I will stop here and just again indicate that we at Minnesota Housing, and I think the housing community, thinks this is a very solid and robust budget that will allow us to continue to affordably house Minnesotans, address their and the state's broader quality of life needs. And I'll be happy to address any questions or go into more detail any specific item.
Any questions, Senator Metzen?
Yeah, Tim, I should know, but would you explain how we've got a very active Dakota County HRA and how you intertwine with them, and we've got a wonderful director down there, and whether it be senior housing or rehab, I mean, they're doing a great job. But how do you guys work? Do you give them any money?
Right to the point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, yes, we give them lots of money, and they do very good work. So, for example, on that Heart of the City example that I talked about earlier, that is one in which the Dakota County Community Development Agency used their tax credit, used their home funds, to help with that project, but they can't do it all on alone, so the state partners with them on their projects. Dakota County, as well, uses a single-family rehabilitation program. We provide them money. The Dakota County uses the Family Homeless Prevention Program, as well as they probably use all of these programs. So they're a strong delivery partner of ours, as is the HRAs in all of your counties and all of your cities. We couldn't do our work without them. They are the on-the-ground retail provider. We are the wholesale funder.
Thank you very much.
Any questions of the commissioner? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. That was a very good presentation, very timely. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Fischbach, you're very happy with him.
Mm-hmm. That was the first one.
Commissioner, you got to be pretty happy with the 62% increase, huh?
I suppose, Mr. Chair, we can't admit to being too happy in this situation, but we are certainly not complaining and think it will allow us to keep doing a lot of good work.
But if I heard you correctly, in actual dollars, it's still about $10 million below where you could be if it inflated.
If you looked at inflation as a factor, that's correct.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
I remembered. I did have a question. I found out. Sorry, Commissioner. Here,
that's all right.
You're relaxed, and then. So I just found out a few days ago in the presentation by Deed that they control some housing dollars. I think that come in through the feds. I'm not remembering how much that is exactly. It was a surprise to me. Do you coordinate? I think they claim to have. Coordinate with you on spending that money, but I wanted to ask you too. I think it's HUD money or CDBG dollars or something like that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, they do receive the federal CDBG dollars for the smaller cities, and I think 50-60% of those CDBG resources do go for housing. They are a funding partner as a part of our consolidated RFP process, and we do coordinate with them. But I do think, as we talked about earlier in the overview, all of the state agencies could do a better job, I think, of coordinating their resources toward achieving the quality of life outcomes that we talk about in terms of how we really maximizing the environmental impact of how we do housing overall and relate that to transportation. So I think we're doing good, but I think there's always room for improvement, and we're working at it to try to break out of our silos wherever we can.
Great. Well, thanks. Well, I think y'all are the housing folks, so you know, to the extent that I can assist in that, please let me know.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, thank you again. Senator Metzen, why don't you introduce our next guest?
Sure.
Can I help your presentation?
I can help you along anyway.
Are you sure you
Kevin,
want
to? You want to come up too, buddy?
No way.
Had your turn, huh? All right, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Scott Brenner. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Sitting with me is Cindy Farrell, the department's chief financial officer. I'm going to kind of kick this off and go into some basic organizational structure of the department that you've already heard once, so it's going to be about a minute. And then we're going to dive right into the numbers, and I'm going to have Cindy work primarily with you on the number development. Now, we are not working directly off of your budget books. So what I would propose we do is work off the PowerPoint, although it's paper in this room, presentation. We'll try to zip through that as quickly as you wish. And then we are certainly open and willing to work through your budget books in a more detailed manner if that works for
you. Well, it might not be necessary, depending upon what the committee's wishes are here, but is there a way for you to reference a page in the budget book as you go through the slides? And if committee members want to look at a page, they can. Can you do that?
Just
to do that.
We can try our best.
Okay.
Chair. Okay, you folks ready?
Yep.
All right, let's do it. Page one. Our department's mission is to ensure Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. Its vision is to be a trusted resource and an impartial regulator for employees, employers, and property owners. Again, folks, I'm just trying to orient you again with the department. We're not the Minnesota Housing Finance Association, so I want to just remind you what we do. The next page is an org chart. It kind of outlines in a schematic format how we do business and what types of business, what lines of business we participate in. As you can see, we break into primarily, from a policy perspective, we break down into three functional areas of work, one being workers' compensation, another being our safety codes and services division, which is OSHA, primarily the two arms of OSHA, the voluntary arm of OSHA and the compliance arm of OSHA, and the newer unit for us, the construction codes and licensing division. The third policy area, run by Rosalind Wade, is our apprenticeship and labor standards division. My deputy commissioner, Michael Houston, who serves primarily as a COO, a chief operating officer of the department, is responsible for the general services activities. That's all of my very brief overview.
I have my glasses on and I can't read these boxes. So can you just read these boxes, like start under the commissioner and then just
on the org chart, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, what those titles are, because I don't know. It's not very clear.
Right.
Being strong at glasses.
I know it's getting.
Give him a tripod. He'll be able to see.
Can you all see it?
Yeah.
If you can all see it, then I won't make him read them.
I can see it.
Can everybody see them?
Yep.
All right, I need new glasses. All right, never mind. We don't need to do it. Okay.
We usually do this on a screen using a PowerPoint presentation, but I was told we couldn't do it in this room.
And why were you told that?
So with that, Cindy, why don't we dive right into the numbers?
Nice bridge.
Why can't we do PowerPoints in here?
Can do PowerPoints.
Yeah.
Oh, can we set up screens here? I was told differently.
We're not going to do it today.
All right.
Okay. All right.
Now on we'll know. Cindy?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Farrell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the department, and I'm here to give you an overview of the governor's budget recommendations for the department. The total budget is just under $272 million for the biennium, and it's broken down into several funds. And this expenditures by fund breakdown ties to page 5 of our budget book, which is the agency overview page. As you can see, the general fund appropriation is $1.8 million and represents less than 1% of the budget. This appropriation funds the labor standards unit. Most of the other category represents an appropriation for our apprenticeship unit from the Workforce Development Fund. And the other category also includes a small amount, $20,000, from an agency fund that is used as a pass-through account by our labor standards unit for back wages that it collects from employers on behalf of employees. Federal funds represent 4% of the budget and amount to just under $12 million. DLI receives 5 grants from the federal government. The largest are for our OSHA programs, OSHA compliance and OSHA consultation. We also received 2 smaller research grants and 1 grant for approving apprenticeship programs for veterans. The Construction Code Fund is a new fund proposed to support the consolidation of the construction-related activities within DLI. Currently, 2 of the activities, residential contractors and boiler and high-pressure piping, are funded from the general fund. The remainder of the activities, plumbing, electrical, and building codes, are funded from the special revenue fund. One of our change items that I'll get into at the end is to consolidate these activities into a single fund called the Construction Code Fund. Once implemented, this fund will total $53 million and represent 20% of the agency's budget. The special revenue fund is $10 million, and the largest part of this is from the contractor recovery fund. This fund provides financial relief to homeowners who were aggrieved by actions of building contractors. Other special revenue expenditures include agency indirect cost recoveries and fees for seminars conducted by the agency. As you can see, the Workers' Compensation Fund represents the majority of the agency's expenditures at $193 million, or 74%. For the benefit of new members to this committee, I'd like to give you a brief overview of this fund and the activities that it represents. The next page you will not find in our budget book. It's additional information. The purpose of the Workers' Compensation Fund is to provide special benefits and services under workers' compensation law. The agency's Claims Services and Investigations Unit administers three benefit programs through this fund, and those programs represent 53% of the agency's expenditures. Those three programs include supplementary benefits, second injury benefits, and benefits paid to employees of uninsured and bankrupt self-insured employers. The first two benefit programs were repealed in the early 90s for new injuries. However, there's a long tail of projected payments extending to about 2049 for injuries that occurred prior to when those programs were repealed. The fourth item on this slide shows the expenditures from this fund for operating costs within DLI. It funds the entire Workers' Compensation Division, the majority of the General Support Division, and also provides the matching dollars for our two federal OSHA programs. The last item shows amounts appropriated from this fund to other state agencies that play a role in the workers' compensation system. These agencies include the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the Department of Commerce, and these total just under $20 million. The next slide is a repeat of one you probably saw in the agency overview. The fund is financed by an assessment made to workers' compensation insurers and self-insured employers based upon the amount of indemnity paid to injured workers with lost time claims. The current assessment rate is 23.69%, and it's been declining in recent years, primarily due to those two repealed programs that are in runoff.
Cindy, what's the 23.69% a percentage of?
It is a percentage of lost time claims paid throughout the state by insurers and self-insured employers. But so as they're paying out benefits to the workers, they report those to our agency, and then the rate is calculated using that.
But doesn't everybody pay into the workers' comp fund? I mean, don't all businesses pay into the workers' comp fund?
Either directly if they're a self-insured employer or indirectly through their insurance premium, they're paying into this fund.
Okay.
The next slide is our expenditures by program, and those dollar amounts can also be found on page 5 of the budget document. As you can see, workers' compensation benefits represent 53% of our agency's expenditures, and the remainder are broken down into the four operating divisions of the agency: workers' compensation, safety codes and services, labor standards and apprenticeship, and general support. And the next three slides show a little more detailed breakdown within each of those divisions. The Workers' Compensation Division budget can be found on page 9 of the budget book. The entire division is financed from the Workers' Compensation Fund. There is $80,000 from the Special Revenue Fund that is from fees collected for seminars that the division conducts.
Is the Vinland Center still in the base of this budget?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the Vinland Center receives a grant of $150,000 per year.
Thank you.
The next slide is our Safety Codes and Services Division, and that is found on page 26 of the budget document. (Clears throat) In this division, the Construction Code Fund will finance the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, which we also refer to as CCLD. OSHA compliance and workplace safety consultation are funded by federal grants and the Workers' Compensation Fund. And the special revenue amount here is mostly from the Contractor Recovery Fund again, but it also includes some seminar money that's collected by the division. Next is the funding for the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Division, which is on page 48 of your budget. Again, the Workforce Development Fund is the portion that's for the apprenticeship program, and the general fund is the portion for labor standards. The federal line on this slide is the grant from the VA for approving apprenticeship programs for veterans. And the agency fund is the pass-through account I mentioned earlier that's used by our labor standards unit. And the general support division is found on page 52. And this division supports agency operations through services such as communications, legal, financial, human resources, IT, and research. It's financed primarily by the Workers' Compensation Fund and also recovers agency indirect costs from agency programs that are financed through other funds. The federal funds are grants from the U.S. Department of Labor for conducting the annual Bureau of Labor Statistics and OSHA surveys. The next slide is a summary of our change items, and I will walk through the highlights of each of these requests on the next pages. And the more detail can be found in the budget documents, and I'll point out the pages for each one as we go through. The first change item is for a compensation adjustment. We heard about this from other agencies' presentations. This provides an adjustment for estimated increases in salary and benefit costs for state employees. It includes 2% per year for general fund activities and 3.25% per year for other funds. And these appropriation increases are needed to maintain current service levels. And that is found on page 54 of the budget. The next change is some fee changes within our Construction Codes and Licensing Division. The narrative for that is found on page 28. And there is four parts to this change item. In 2004, license fees collected by the boiler and high-pressure piping activities were increased to help resolve the general fund budget shortfall. This proposal reverses that increase and would bring fees collected more in line with the cost of providing those services. This license fee reduction amounts to $254,000 per year, and that would be from the general fund, a reduction in revenue. The next two pieces go together. Our stakeholders have recommended increases to the Contractor Recovery Fund claim limits in order to provide additional compensation directly to homeowners. Currently, the annual license fee paid by building contractors includes two parts. The first is a base $100 for the actual license, and the second part is a fee to the Contractor Recovery Fund. That fee varies from between $100 and $200, depending on the licensee's gross annual revenue. This proposal would redirect $30 of the base license fee to the Contractor Recovery Fund and increase the Contractor Recovery Fund fee by an additional $30. And the net result would be a $30 increase in fee to the contractors who are paying into this fund. And it would reduce general fund revenue by $521,000 per year and increase contractor recovery fee by over $1 million per year. With that increase, we would increase limits that are paid out to homeowners. The current limits are $50,000 per claimant, and it's subject to a limit of $75,000 per licensee. And those limits would increase to $75,000 per claimant and $150,000 per licensee. The last part of this change item is proposed increases to electrical inspection fees, and that is just under $3 million per year. These additional revenues will be used to improve inspection services throughout the state and to expand on educational offerings for the electrical field. The next change is a code consolidation, and that's on page 30.
Can I ask a question? Are these just department recommendations, governor's recommendations? Are they as a result of conversations with the industries? What prompted the changes in these fees?
Mr. Chair, members, the fee increases themselves, where we are advocating fee increases, they came from the constituency groups themselves. Where we are advocating reducing fee levels, those were primarily department-driven.
And are they base? They're obviously base numbers. They're not one-time numbers.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Backing up to the slide that you had that had to do with compensation adjustments, and you're talking about a 2% per year recommendation by the governor, do you have a projection in terms of the cost of additional benefits? Is that included within that 2%? And if those benefits are going to rise fairly dramatically, is that going to absorb any additional salaries that increases you might have been able to pay?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, the guidelines given to us from the Department of Finance were to assume a 3.25% increase per year. However, the general fund amount available to go around was 2% allocated, so that does leave a shortfall, an estimated shortfall for the coming biennium for general fund programs. The 3.25% is intended to fund increases in health insurance, as well as anticipated increases from collective bargaining negotiations, as well as current step increases.
And so that gap you see between the 3.25 and the 2, you'll see offset in a second when we get to labor standards, which is our only general funded entity. We have a additional change item there to offset that imbalance.
Senator Olson.
So does that mean that by failing to fund the actual cost of the projected increases for health care and things you've contracted for in terms of salary increases and so forth, that you will have to be providing fewer services or laying off people? Or what is this going to translate into just in layman's terms?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I can speak for my department only. With us, because we're only general funded, our labor standards unit is the only unit that's general funded. So, yes, if we are not given additional relief there, which we are asking, we just haven't gotten to it yet, we will be short-staffed in that particular environment.
Commissioner, I'm seeing a whole bunch of statutory changes at the end of each of these sections, and so I'm assuming we're going to get a bill from you that's going to have all those in it, because I know these fees that you're changing here aren't cross-referenced in the housing bill, and I think they go hand in hand, if I'm not mistaken. But do they need to talk to the housing people to let them know they're doing this, or?
Mr. Chairman, I think it was unusual for the Housing Finance Agency to have a bill for other agencies in their presentation. Obviously, they left some things out, which include the changes in fees. So I understand we'll have another bill to look at.
Cindy?
Mr. Chairman, our executive budget officer informed me that the governor's budget bill will be introduced sometime this week.
Okay. Go ahead. Any other questions before she goes on? Okay, continue, please.
The next change item related to construction code consolidation. It's on page 30. This change item would create the new construction code fund and consolidate all revenue and expenditure of the CCLD activities into this new fund. The consolidation of funding sources would help to support the structural reorganization that is necessary to create efficiencies and provide more streamlined services to agency customers and stakeholders. It also eliminates an accounting complexity involved with maintaining separate funding mechanisms based on the current siloed approach. This change item would also dedicate the penalties collected by CCLD to be used for providing safety grants through our Workplace Safety Consultation Unit. And it does have a net cost to the general fund after we remove all revenues and expenditures related to residential contractors and boiler and high-pressure piping activities. The net cost is a little over $1 million each year of the biennium.
And what's the reason the governor wants to do this?
Mr. Chair, members, a couple points here. One, this won't be relevant to the new members, but this was the same package that was brought forth that passed through the Senate last year, so it's not new. But a little history here to give you some rationale why we're approaching it this way. This unit, this construction code and licensing division, is comprised of a variety of former divisions that were found disparate within state government. The Department of Labor and Industry took jurisdiction over what was an independent Board of Electricity a year and a half ago through an executive order. Same executive order. We took jurisdiction over a plumbing division that was housed at the Department of Health, the building code and elevators group that was housed over at admin, the residential contractor unit that was housed at commerce. That was all amalgamated into the Department of Labor and Industry because we already had a piece of that code work. We already had high-pressure piping and boilers. The thought process was to create a one-stop code construction unit, which makes a lot of sense. If you were building a building prior to a year and a half ago, you had to go to five or six different state agencies to canvass their process, work through their bureaucratic processes in order to construct your infrastructure. So through the governor's executive order, we took six different pieces of state government, brought them into the Department of Labor and Industry, and have created a one-stop integrated code construction unit. Because each of these components had different historical developments associated with their creation, we inherited primarily, functionally, six different financing mechanisms. They were financed differently, some through special revenue funds, some through general fund equations. And so what we have proposed to do here, from an internal perspective, it's hard to manage, frankly, and account for six different funding streams funneling into one program area. So what we've done, we've created one unified special revenue fund that is associated with this unit, the construction code unit, trying to make it completely transparent. It will be user-based. It will be license fee-based primarily. And so that, in macrocosmic terms, is why we're coming to the legislature.
So the conceivable, the executive order happened because the legislature didn't want to do it. Okay, that's what I'm getting out of this. But now, is there?
I'm not sure if that's the case. It was part of the Drive to Excellence proposals. It was a business case developed by Drive to Excellence, and I don't know.
Okay,
maybe you would know that more than myself.
Okay, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm not. But anyway, my question is: then you have several different divisions that are they're paying fees into this consolidated fund. Is that how it's working?
So in some cases, yes. In some cases, no.
So is it possible that one division could be picking up the cost for the other just because they're all in one consolidated thing, or are they still going to be line items out for this amount of money goes to plumbing, this amount goes to, how are you doing that? Just out of curiosity.
You have to speak to the accounting. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, the intent would be that costs are more closely tied to the services that are being provided. So we're trying to develop a mechanism where inspection fees are going to pay for the cost of inspections. License fees will pay for the cost of licensing. The current difficulties we have is we're splitting costs by fund one way and by organization another, and it's very difficult to integrate that third level, which would be by fee type or service type, into that matrix. The intent would be, if it's all in one fund, that we could focus more on tying those individual costs to individual activities.
So you haven't started doing this yet. You just want to start doing it. Is it, or you have started doing it yet? Or how?
Mr. Chairman, this would be a proposal effective July with the consolidated fund.
Okay. All right. And how is the industry accepting it?
Based upon the conversations I've had over the last year, this isn't – I'm not getting pushback on this concept. I think they recognize if they're paying fees, the fees should go to providing those services. They may tell you something different, but
I haven't had a discussion. I was wondering if you had
I have not had pushback. I've had pushback to some degree on some issues in the construction code world, absolutely. But on creating a transparent integrated revenue fund, I have not received any pushback on that.
So is it your intent to come together with all these players to make sure that everybody's happy?
Absolutely.
I'm learning this from Senator Metzen because, it's peace in the valley is way easier than
Mr. Chair and members, let me tell you how we've processed this this bill. This bill came out originally last January or February. It was heard, I think it passed out of all Senate committees, in fact, with this element in it. There was some pushback saying we haven't had time to digest it, we need more time. So over the course of the summer and the fall, we held extensive stakeholder hearings with respect to not just the funding component, that was part of it, but there's a broader bill that will be brought forth this session to the legislature that addresses some policy components as well. I bet we've had some folks behind me could give you more exact answers than myself, but I bet we've had 8 or 10 at least big department hearings on this between June and December. A lot of it's been negotiated out. To my knowledge, most of it has been. I would assume there'll be some amendments that'll be thrown here and there to address some individual constituency issues. But this bottom line is this bill has been probably more air time has been given to walking folks and getting people comfortable with this proposal than probably any other bill I've worked on in 14 years of doing this type of work.
So you're getting the hang of it, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there is more to this bill, but from a financial perspective, which is all we're bringing to the table today, this is what it's all about. It's integrating 6 or 7 different revenue streams into one transparent user pay, user use funding vehicle,
okay.
Funding mechanism.
Okay. Go ahead. Keep going.
The next change is federal OSHA benchmark staffing. That can be found on page 32 of your budget book, the document. This is a request for additional funding in our OSHA compliance unit. Last year, the federal OSHA program provided us with a tool to analyze the staffing levels within Minnesota's OSHA program and compare those levels to federal benchmarks. This analysis took into consideration such elements as Minnesota's population, industry mix, and number of injuries and illnesses. The result of this was a determination that Minnesota's OSHA program is understaffed by 12 FTE. Since this is a 50-50 matching program with the feds, We're requesting an increase in our appropriation from the Workers' Compensation Fund of $460,000 per year, which would fund six of those 12 FTE. And that additional appropriation will allow us to request a similar increase in federal funds. The additional funds directed in this program, both state and federal, will be used to expand OSHA compliance inspections and also OSHA compliance assistance activities.
Is the workers' comp fund overfunded?
Mr. Chair, I would not say that the workers' comp fund is overfunded, but it is adequate to support all the change items presented here.
Mr. Chair, we reassess that every year when we determine what the assessment rate should be gauged at. So we specifically keep it non-overfunded.
And we're not having any trouble paying claims?
No.
And there was a time when there was a big surplus, I think, right after the 95 bill, sometime after the 95 bill. And I think you had to give money back, didn't you, to some of the premium payers? I know the insurance companies got most of it, but.
Mr. Chair, members, that was the assigned risk account. And what I wasn't at the department at the time, but as I recall what occurred, and Cindy, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, there was a surplus in the assigned risk account. Monies were transferred by the legislature to the special compensation fund to pay off old claims to ultimately reduce liability on behalf of the special compensation fund. What actually occurred, I was not at the department this time. We got into a budget pinch, the state, and the legislature took that surplus money back to offset the deficit, state deficit. But that was distinct from any special compensation fund overages.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Farrell.
The next change request is on page 49 of your budget book.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this is the issue that goes to your issue of the disparity between the 2 and the 3.25.
This request is $200,000 per year from the general fund for our labor standards unit. As Commissioner had indicated, this program is the agency's only pure general fund activity, and it has suffered considerably from the general fund budget cuts over the past several years. This change item would add 2.5 FTE, restoring the unit staffing levels to fiscal year 2 levels. And these staff will be used to support the unit's primary activities of investigating complaints and responding to telephone inquiries, as well as making improvements to the prevailing wage survey process.
Okay. This is the last slide.
Our final change item is a technology initiative, and this is on page 53 of the budget document. This is proposed to enhance the department's ability to transact business electronically with workers' compensation system participants. Those participants include injured workers, employers, insurers, and third-party administrators. We would be developing a two-way interface to our workers' compensation database, allowing those entities to provide information to us and receive information back from us regarding their claims. The one-time cost for the development of this interface is $200,000, and ongoing costs of $90,000 per year include hardware and software, maintenance, ongoing web authentication services, and one technical staff person to support the application.
And how do we do it now?
It's done through, Mr. Chair and members, the system is primarily driven off an electronic imaging process.
And is this paper who has access? Who
would based have, off premised off paper, right?
Yeah. Who would have access to the information you're talking about here?
That's still being worked out. It's. It, I mean, it, we're working through the data privacy concerns. I'd like to make it a little more open and user-friendly so attorneys can use it when they need to. But those questions have yet to be. This money will help establish some of those parameters. We're looking into it. I mean, Cindy, do you have any? Or Patricia? It still remains relatively unclear. We're trying to create as open of a system as we can.
Because these records
are bounded on data privacy.
Yeah, these are private records.
Yeah, so, though they're used, the attorneys use them, the medical providers use them, they're used, but we redact much of the information. I mean, the SSIs, for example, are redacted, names are redacted. But there are different constituency groups that do need access to these records, that currently have access to these records.
Okay. Anything else? No? Senator Metz, did you have a...
No. Oh, I'm just listening.
Okay, what else?
Go ahead.
That's all we got.
Oh, yeah, we had a discussion in Senator Metzen's committee about the prevailing wage and the report from the auditor. You have a request in for some FTEs here for enforcement. Is that in?
Let me clarify what the labor, Mr. Chair and members, the labor standards request that you see as a change item here that represents 2.5 FTEs. One of those FTEs represents this differential between the 2 and the 3.25. So it puts us back on level playing ground. That's one FTE. The additional 1.5 FTEs we're requesting through the governor's change recommendations is to enhance the survey, to refine the survey process associated with prevailing wage. What this does not address is prevailing wage enforcement, which the legislative auditor's report that I believe was recently heard in Senator Metzen's committee. This does not reflect what we would need. And frankly, the enforcement, our enforcement needs would be premised on what enforcement authority we're given.
What would you prefer to see here? Because this discussion was pretty interesting. Ms. Wade was in there. And we were talking about the fact that MnDOT has its own enforcement, and yet Dolly's in charge of everything else. Would you rather see your department receive more money to be able to do enforcement, or would you rather see the Minsku system do their own enforcement and the University of Minnesota?
Minsku or Min? Well,
yeah, or the University of Minnesota do their own enforcement. Would it be your preference for Dolly to have the control they have right now and just have the resources to do it?
I think it'd be easier to work through the process. I think MnDOT should retain their authority over highway construction activities. I mean, they own the contract in those situations.
We're not changing that.
Outside of that, I just assume you give it to us. You expand the compliance provisions in Chapter 177 to include prevailing wage, which they do not currently include. So we have the same tools to go after folks that we have with minimum wage, child labor, overtime, that type of arrangement. That would require, I don't think a lot, 2, 3, 4 people maybe. I don't think we're talking about an arsenal of people, but it would require a few bodies. Or maybe you do a certain level and then we study it, we come back to you in 2, 3 years, see how much noncompliance there is, and either come at for a reduction or an increase. But
Senator Metzen.
I think the report says we're past the study stuff. I mean,
Senator Metzen, I agree with you. I mean, look, it's a line of business that we take responsibility for. That to be honest with you, I think the auditor's office was frank with you on this. We do not have the compliance authority that we have with other issue areas governed in Chapter 177. So if we simply spread the compliance authority associated in the same chapter, same body of law that governs not just prevailing wage, but minimum wage, overtime, child labor, we can combat this problem, I think, pretty easily. It would require 2, 3, 4 people.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, except that it just seems to me, Commissioner, you guys should be, if you know it's not getting done, you should be proactive coming into us saying, here's the language we need changed, and we're going to need 6 people. You should be telling us that, not the auditor. And if it's not getting done, It should be getting done. So anyway, that's why we're here too. We'll be in that area, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I think we can work cooperatively on this one. I mean, frankly, we haven't gotten a lot of complaints, but maybe that's because they know we don't have the tools to combat it if we did get the complaints, at least in my tenure there. It's been the same process that's been in place for 20-something years.
Yeah.
So this isn't a Scott Brenner or Palenty issue, but, you know, I'm a lawyer. I take kind of the – my philosophy is if we have responsibility for a certain body of law, we need to go at it. So I think we can work cooperatively on this one.
We're going to have to look. Mr. Chairman, we're going to have to look at this. We're going to look at it.
We're going to look at it. Well, the reason I asked you the question was because it appeared that MnDOT has a very good system in place, and they don't seem to have any problem with it because they aren't policing it, whereas the rest of the state contracts are admittedly you don't have enough people to do the job, and so you're not going out there and doing it, is my understanding.
We don't have the contracts. That's a huge difference between us and MnDOT.
But aren't you responsible for everything else?
Yeah, but we don't own the contract.
Okay, so my question to you then is does it make more sense for us to say, Minsku, you're getting $160 million in contracts this year, you police the prevailing wage, University of Minnesota, you're getting $160 million this year, you police the prevailing wage, or would it make more sense for us to give you the personnel and have you police those contracts?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to bring Rosalind away. I think most of you folks know Rosalind. Rosalind has been in the prevailing wage business here for 20 years, and frankly, I rely on Rosalind quite a bit in this world. So, Roz, she started in a high school, so that's why she's been there so long.
She was getting punished the other day.
She liked to stay in the back row.
Yeah, I know.
Now, this might be a simple yes-no answer, so you could be out of here in a hurry. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rosalind Wade. The commissioner and I have had some long discussions about this. From our perspective, I think it makes more sense to retain to clearly establish enforcement authority in the labor standards unit. The prevailing wage is a part of the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act. I think the differences between MnSKU, the Minnesota Zoo, and the Department of Administration is clearly MnDOT is in the business of building roads. They own the contract. They are a part of every element of road construction. MnSKU, the zoo, they're in a different kind of business. MnSKU is in education. The zoo is into housing animals. It is my opinion that they do not have a clear understanding of the requirements, the complexities of prevailing wage. Certainly, resources can be directed that way, but I think it would have a greater fiscal impact to establish many enforcement units in each of those. They would still have to rely on labor and industry for some technical expertise. My staff currently perform payroll audits for purposes of minimum wage and overtime. Clearly expanding that to include prevailing wage auditing and utilizing the existing tools to ensure compliance seems to make more sense to me.
Okay, so you're going to work with Senator Metzen and I on this and
Mr. Chair,
make sure we get it right, okay?
And Mr. Chair, we are also working with Representative Ruccovina on this on the House side.
Oh,
so
no.
If I can get through him, I can get through you guys. On the
bring Ms. Wade along. She'll help you a lot with Ruccovina, okay? Okay, any other questions of the department? Do you have any more comments? Do you need to let us know anything else?
We're done.
Ms. Wade wants to go to bed.
Cap, what's coming next?
Mr. Chair, Senator, next week we begin bill hearings, and we have a few more reviews. Members, we have a number of bills that have been referred to our committee. However, we are still somewhat short on bill hearing requests. So if you have a bill in committee and you'd like to get it heard, a hearing request will be a very simple way to expedite the process.
And like I told you all before, we'll hear all these bills. We'll be laying them over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill because we don't know what our targets are going to be for quite a while yet. And I'm assuming that we're not going to know until at least after the February forecast. And then I would think there's going to be some negotiating within leadership to try and figure out exactly what that number is going to be. So it'll be a while before we know what our actual target is. So we'll just keep these bills on the table and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So with that, any questions by committee members? Meeting adjourned.
She'd have rather stayed home. But she'd